We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another outstanding author joining us this week. He is the three-time champion of Slovakia, the highest-rated player in the country, and an award-winning author, in fact. His 2018 book, Under the Surface, has been recommended on this very podcast many times, and it was the winner of the ECF Book of the Year that year. He's out with another offering from our friends at Quality Chess. This one is called The Secret Ingredient. It is co-authored by Super Grandmaster David Navarra. And this one is more about the practical side of chess, and I've been reading it in anticipation of this interview. And it's also a fantastic book, so I'm excited to talk about both of these books and about our guest's career. So let's go ahead and introduce him, Grandmaster Jan Markos. Jan, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for your invitation, Ben.
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, there's, as we were discussing just moments ago, there's so much chess content now that often there's people that I'm very eager to interview, and it's just a matter of like, okay, this is the week. And obviously with your new offering from Quality Chess, I felt like it was a good time, and I've been really enjoying digging into both of your books in recent weeks. So if you don't mind, Jan, we'll save the chit chat for later in the interview and just dive right into the books. Are you ready?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I thought we would start with Under the Surface. And for listeners, I do want to give a bit of context, just my personal impression. As I said, both of, and Jan actually has three books. He also wrote a 2008 book about the King's Indian, which if you're a King's Indian player, you guys are welcome to check out. But you know how it is with opening books. They're very specific and theory evolves quickly and stuff like that. So we'll be primarily discussing Jan's more recent works. Now, Under the Surface, I should say both of Jan's books are, I would say, ideally suited for more advanced players, but as has been the case with a few recently discussed books, it's sort of philosophical, especially Under the Surface, and The Secret Ingredient is more practical. So there's lessons that I think are very universal for all players, especially tournament players, but did just want to give a warning that the chess material itself is reasonably advanced, as you might expect when it's a grandmaster, one of the top players in his country writing the book, as Jan is. So without further ado, I thought, Jan, we would start off by, I would read you a quote from Under the Surface, and maybe you could expound on it a little bit. Does that sound good?
Okay, let's do it.
Excellent. So hopefully you won't claim to be misquoted. So you say, Jan, I learned that the significant difference between a club player and a professional is not that the grandmaster can see much further or that he can calculate much more accurately or faster. This might all be true, but the significant difference can be found elsewhere. Grandmasters can see deeper, and this book invites you to study the depth of chess. So could you expound a little bit on what you mean by that, Jan?
Well, maybe this quote is very nice because it sums up what interests myself in chess. I really like the depth of chess. The depth of ideas which are hidden behind the moves. And I was never a real fighter, although being reasonably successful when playing. What I was mostly interested in is the depth of chess ideas. Many times club players think that when they solve another 100 diagrams or they buy another opening book or do something like that, they will kind of automatically get to a higher level, to a competitive level or grandmaster level or so. But what differs really is the understanding. So analyzing with strong players and speaking with them. Is what might be the difference. And that's, as I said, really what interests myself, the depth of ideas in chess.
Yeah, and in addition to the depth, Jan, you also in the book talk about the width of ideas, which is something that I definitely, it resonated with me. I'm about a 2100 player, and I do find that often it's not so much that the moves I see, I don't calculate well enough, as you say, that may be true, but it's also just to entirely miss ideas. So in your work as a trainer, do you have any advice or observations about what adults can do to increase the width of their vision to make sure that they don't miss moves?
Well, first of all, you need to think about the position in words, not only in some kind of lines or analysis of moves, because when you speak about the position or try to describe it and discuss it in your head with words, you might think about the concepts as well and come up with some kind of new fresh idea. This is very typical in brainstorming, not only in chess but also in other areas, that there are some ideas which come up very quickly. And you just automatically, they spring into your head because this is how your head is wired up. And then there is some time when there are no ideas and you just need to force yourself to get through this desert of zero ideas. And I think here the thinking in words rather than moves might help. Yeah? Just asking about the pieces, about the key concepts and so on. But you also, this is also quite important. You also need to know the concept. Actually, you need to know how to think about the position in words, and this is what I was trying to do in Under the Surface, to just give a new language to some concepts which we might intuitively somehow understand, but we lack clarity. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And hearing you talk about sort of the distinction between thoughts that come to you automatically and thoughts that you kind of have to reach for made me think of the fact that you quoted Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman in one of your books. And I really enjoyed that book. And I know Grandmaster Jesse Cry in some of the work he does with Chess Dojo has talked about it. So hearing you talk like that made me wonder, and I know JJ Lang, who's been on the podcast, Adult Improver, is a big fan of Under the Surface. He also chimed in on Twitter wondering sort of what your background is to have sort of such a wide array of references in both of your books.
Mm-hmm. I have a master in philosophy and Protestant theology. It means that I was also dealing with thinking and the depth of thoughts even outside the region of chess. And I'm also the author of several non-chess books on ethical dilemmas, on hoaxes and disinformations, on the connection of science and phenomenology, let's say. So quite complex areas, I would say. And somehow, like, thinking is something what I like to do and what I maybe do quite well.
That's interesting. Both Jesse Cry and JJ Lang also have philosophy backgrounds. So before we get back to the chess books, Jan, is your primary profession chess, or is your primary work outside of chess?
Well, at this moment, it's maybe 50-50. Yeah, I work mostly as a chess coach, and sometimes I write something. I have to admit that I didn't play a tournament game for maybe more than a year, but I'm coaching, but I'm also lecturing companies and NGOs and so on in critical thinking and other non-chess stuff. So it's like I'm standing on both these legs.
Sounds pretty fun. So you basically read a lot, I guess.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, and that definitely comes across in your works. So let's get to another quote. First I'll read the quote, and then I'll dive into the second question, which is from supporter of the podcast, Chris Wainscott, and they're kind of intertwined. So in Under the Surface, you say, each piece on the chessboard should be regarded from three perspectives. First, as an active tool that we can use to achieve our goals. Second, as a vulnerable and valuable creature, which requires care all the time. Third, it's important as a, quote, piece of wood, which is standing in the way of its fellows. And then Chris wrote in to ask, another fan of Under the Surface, by the way, wrote in to ask, he said, Under the Surface had a very unique approach to covering its subject matter. For example, the three faces of a piece. I'm wondering how you decided to explain the concepts the way you did. Did you decide what you wanted to write about and then come up with such a unique way to present the material? Or was that already how you thought about the lessons?
Mm-hmm. Maybe I should reveal the background. How was Under the Surface, how it came to life? Actually, I was writing articles for myself for several years, thinking about some concepts and just writing them. And I didn't have in my head that I want to write a book. I just wanted to collect the ideas which I found interesting about chess. Then I put it on some Czech chess webpage, and I understood that they are quite liked. So then I collected them and created the book. So basically, Under the Surface is a book which I wrote for myself. For me to clarify the concepts and to understand myself what I'm actually thinking about chess. And I also use the concepts when I was coaching, for example. I feel that when we come to the three faces of a piece, that mostly the amateur players or the club players, they usually focus on the active face of the piece. And they just don't feel the vulnerability enough and don't feel the harmony between the pieces enough. So I just felt this might be a nice way how to show it. And also, the more lively the metaphor is, and the more it sticks into the head, the more it is educational, let's say. So that's what I was trying to do as well, to make it a bit mysterious and very sticky.
Yeah, it's quite sticky and quite illuminating. Do you feel, Jan, like you kind of always had a unique perspective? Like when you were sort of rising through the ranks in the chess world, did you always feel like you kind of looked at the game in a different way? Or do you feel like you just are able to explain it in a different way?
I think that my approach was always focused on understanding rather than and explaining rather than getting the successes. So I was never very good in timing my shape for some important tournament or just some tournament strategies or whatever. I quite often lost games in some tense situations because I didn't have the nerves to overcome it. but the understanding and the thinking about chess, unpractical and abstract thinking, was always something what did interest me.
Okay, yeah, it comes across. And again, it's for any listeners who struggle with like a certain idea, I think that these books are great, especially under the surface, again, for philosophical and in terms of like actionable advice. Definitely recommend The Secret Ingredient. So I'm going to dive in, Jan, to another Twitter question. This one is from Dances with Worms. And he asked you, what do you think is well covered by chess instruction and what is missing? Is there a field that chess should learn from? And then he says, also, why do adult improvers find it so difficult to find books that result in material improvement, despite so many of these books being really very good texts?
Well, the answer to this question is actually the second book we will speak about, Secret Ingredient.
Exactly. Because I've got some good quotes for that.
Because what I felt before I, and of course together with David Navarra, when we were speaking together, like how should we build up the book, we just felt that there are plenty of people which have lots of chess knowledge, but the knowledge is very theoretical. Yeah, they have hundreds of books which they can quote from, but they have problems to actually, when they're sitting at the board, to just show the knowledge and show the class they have. So I think the field which is not well covered by many authors is the practical side of chess. How to decide at the board, how to defend, especially positional defense, how to manage your time, how to prepare, for example, and so on. Of course, the easiest way how you can create many chess books is to focus on openings. So this area is just overcrowded, I would say. And the practical side of chess is, I think, very scarce to find a nice book on that.
Yeah, there are a few books that come to mind. One being John Nunn's Secrets of Practical Chess, to the point. I recently interviewed your fellow quality chess author, Axel Smith, and his newest book, Street Smart Chess, also, I think, sort of falls under that umbrella. But okay, it's part of my job as doing this podcast, but you can see that I fall into this category, right? I love chess. I play, you know, I made it to about 2200 FIDE when I was 18, and now my knowledge is, you know, has expanded greatly over especially the course of doing this podcast, but my skills are either getting worse or staying the same. So it's funny that even when the problem is diagnosed and even when you're aware of it, that doesn't mean that you're going to make better moves.
Sure. I'm experiencing the same, maybe on a bit higher level, but okay. I also know my faults and it's difficult to improve them. Yeah.
Yeah, and what's going on with your game? So obviously, one of the perks of being the best player in your country, you've played in many Olympiads, you've played Maxime Vachier-Lagrave and other elite players. Are you going to continue to compete for your country internationally, and are you still able to work on your own game, Jan?
Well, actually, I'm rather focusing on my books, especially the non-chess books at the moment, and we have two small kids, so I will probably more focus on coaching and writing and so on. But okay, one day, who knows, I might return. But at this moment, it's not priority to make myself a better player.
So would you still show up and play at something like the Olympiad? Or is it, do you feel like you would need to prepare?
Hopefully yes, but maybe not in the next few weeks, years.
Okay. Yeah. How old are your kids?
They are 4 and 6. So
yeah,
we need some time to spend with them.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. Okay. And next Twitter question is from Puddings Jack. And he asks, what type of players did you have in mind when writing these two books, and who would benefit most from them? Kids, adults, rating range, etc. So I'll let you answer and then I could give my own opinion if you want.
Yeah, when it comes to Under the Surface, I was trying to make it a tram book. So a book which you can read in a tram. Yeah, so don't need two boards, as Nimsovich said, one for analysis, one for the main line. It just, you can read it from cover to cover without the chessboard, I would say. So it should be a book which inspires and not a very, you know, heavyweight book which makes you suffer and work. Maybe it's not well suited for very young kids, because the concepts might be quite elaborate at some moments, but definitely like 10, 12 year old kids are able to read it. And mostly it's well accepted by club players. But even like my friend from the Slovak national team told me after reading that book that he found concepts which he didn't know. So even grandmasters might be inspired sometimes. But again, it's not for absolutely small kids, and it's not for like people who are making their first steps on the chessboard. That's, you need at least to have some tournaments behind you to make the most of it. And when it comes to the secret ingredient, it's mostly for people who want to improve, because it's a less pleasant book, let's say, and it's more about work it's really for people young or senior who want to improve their chess and want to think about how they are playing the game and what could they do better. Basically, it's a book where I distilled my knowledge as a coach. I'm coaching for maybe 15 years now, so here you find what I came up with.
Yeah, and I basically agree. It would have to be a precocious 12-year-old to read your book, because for one thing, you're so worldly. I mean, the references span beyond the chess world, which is to your credit. But I think for someone younger, they might benefit from the chess material, of course, but the sort of broader tying it all together, they might not get the full benefit of. But other than that, I agree. I've noticed Yosin Langstrand, aka Dr. Patzer, wrote a nice review. And actually, I have a question for you, follow-up question from him in a second. But he compared your book to The Seven Deadly Chess Sins, which also gets mentioned a lot on this show. Mm-hmm. In my mind, that's a very favorable comparison. I love that book. His question actually was, and you just mentioned Nimzovich, if you were influenced by Nimzovich or my system in particular, because in his review, he drew that comparison, although I just reread my system and I almost consider that an insult, but I'll let you go ahead.
Well, I will be probably a bit heretical here, because I think that Nimzovich is a great chess thinker, but a very lousy writer, actually. I mean, I really suffered when I was reading his books, because there is a time gap which is significant. Maybe 100 years ago, the books were written a little bit differently, but somehow I don't like the prose, but I like the ideas, so I can live with that.
Yeah. I mean, there is some good stuff in there. I am Christoph Zalecki, Chess Explained, and I have been preparing to do a podcast on my system, which will be coming out not too long, probably after this interview, but you know, I'll just go ahead and spoil it that I basically agree. I found it a bit of a chore to read, even though it obviously is, you know, deserves its place in the canon and was written a long time ago, and maybe there's translation issues and all that. But yeah, I kind of joked to Dr. Patzer that he shouldn't have insulted you when he compared it to my system. Next question. And again, we have so many fans, and a lot of them are very well read and reasonably strong players. This one is from Why Must I Lose to This Idiot, which is also a Nimzovich reference, aka Matt, who said, firstly, thanks for Under the Surface. Your second book is on my wish list. And secondly, are there new chapters you might add if you were writing it today? And he said, for example, he's thinking of things like top players have learned from the new breed of neural net computers, such as AlphaZero.
Definitely the question what can be learned from AlphaZero is like extremely interesting. but I don't feel I have the, you know, the computer skills and all the, you know, programs and analysis tools, and not even the time to analyze what actually happened in the AlphaZero revolution. I think that it was well covered by Matthew Sadler in the Game Changer book. So I would probably avoid that. Definitely there could be some new chapters, but at this moment I don't have one exact topic in mind or whatever.
Yeah, and even though you say that the secret ingredient, obviously it is much more focused on the practical than the philosophical, as compared to Under the Surface, but I feel like if you gave me both books, I would know they were by the same author. So even though they're separate topics, I think that there kind of is a through line between the two books. So definitely, Matt, recommend that you get the secret ingredient as soon as possible. And listeners, we'll be doing, at the end of the podcast, we'll be doing a contest to give away a few of Jan's books. Jan was nice enough to get a headset just for this interview. So the least we can do is get his book in a few more people's hands. So I think we just have, okay, one more question. And then I want to talk about your newer book. So, and this one is more sort of general chess advice. So this is from Martin McGowan on Twitter, who says, I want to know why, after analyzing a position carefully and making the move, does it only take my future self a split second to see the monstrous blunder I just made? Hello, future self. Some help in the present would be appreciated. So I do feel like you're uniquely qualified to answer. Like, what's going on with the sort of neuroscience of noticing a blunder the second you make a move?
Well, I've done exactly this thing several times during my career. I remember when I was playing Jelena Sedina and at the Mitropa Cup on the first board for Slovakia, and I was calculating some lengthy lines, and then I made a move and got a mate in one. So I can relate to this definitely.
Ouch.
Yeah. I think that's the difficult thing is that we are diving in when we are going to, thinking about the position. We are like diving in into it and going into more and more detail and more depth or lengthy lines. And then we have to come out reasonably slowly. Yeah, if we just decide very quickly, and it's the same as if a diver comes very quickly out from some deep lake, it doesn't make it actually doesn't isn't a good idea. We need also like come up out of the water of lines reasonably slowly, so that we can again have a look at all these more basic and generally speaking, stupid things like are my pieces hanging and all this stuff. So maybe just make the move a little bit slower so that your future self can catch up and join you before you actually make the move. That would be my advice.
That's an amazing analogy about sort of coming up from the deep sea, stopping along the way.
Actually, it's like very unhealthy to do it very quickly.
Yeah, dangerous. Yeah. Yeah. That's excellent. Yeah, and it helps to look around. But somehow, no matter how much you look around, you won't see the blunder until you make the move every once in a while. So that gets at the practical side of chess. And on that note, I want to bring it forward to your excellent new book. But first, Jan, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by ChessMood.com. ChessMood is a subscription video service by a team of GMs headed by Grandmaster Avchek Grigorian, who you can hear on episode 192 of Perpetual Chess. They offer a comprehensive video library featuring an opening repertoire for both colors, as well as courses on middle game and end game mastery. They also have great free content. Avchek has an insightful blog, and they have a YouTube channel featuring daily lessons with a Grandmaster. So all the links you need if you want to find out more are in the show description, or just go to chessmood.com and have a look around if you're interested. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. If you haven't checked out aimchess.com by now, what are you waiting for? What Aim Chess does is it collects your games from the major chess sites and then gives you actionable advice of how to improve your game. It might be to work on a specific opening or to get better at end games or improve your time management or whatever it may be. And then it gives you related puzzles to help you improve that specific skill. They are constantly improving the site. They recently added blindfold tactics, time management training, common checkmate patterns. So there's so much to do there. If you decide to subscribe, be sure to use the promo code PERPETUAL30. Details are in the show notes for aimchess.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And we are back. So to give listeners a bit of context, the secret ingredient, as I mentioned at the top, Jan co-authored with Super Grandmaster David Navarra. He's, of course, been one of the best top 25 players in the world, renowned as a nice guy. He's been on this podcast and always insightful in whatever he writes. And the format of the book is it appears to be mostly written by Jan, but then each topic that Jan talks about, as he mentioned, it might be time trouble. It might be agreeing or not agreeing to draws. It might be opening preparation. Those are just some of the examples of the topics. He then asks David to share a few of his insights, of his perspective on those particular topics. And then he asks him a few pointed questions at the end of the chapter. So it's a collaboration with great insights from both grandmasters. Now, Jan, we touched on this earlier, but I actually want to start just drilling a little deeper on the paradox of why adults often can learn more but not play better. So I'm going to read the quote, although again, you alluded to it, but I'll read you the quote verbatim and then maybe we can talk about it a bit more. So I believe it's in the introduction to The Secret Ingredient. You say, "I've come across an interesting paradox in my last 15 years of coaching. Many club players have deep chess knowledge. They're familiar with the theory of openings. They've read everything from Nimzowitsch to Kasparov, and they have a good strategic feeling. And yet, while sitting at the chessboard, they struggle to turn that knowledge into victory." So again, we talked about this, and this is sort of the overriding theme of your book, but what specific prescription would you give? Do we need, like, all guests on the show always say you need to drill more tactics. Is that it? Like, what can we do to translate the knowledge into skills?
Well, actually, I don't think it's so easy that you just need to drill more tactics, because there are many, many aspects of chess praxis that need to be improved, and tactics is just one of them. I think that there is another paradox which is interesting, that the things or the examples or the topics that fit well into chess literature are not the same topics and examples that are actually helpful for a player to improve. Yeah, because, for example, if you want to find a tactical example that fits very nicely into your chapter or into your book, you would find an example which is very clear, easy to explain, nice, and so on and so on. But chess life is not like that. Yeah. So what I think we need to do is actually to focus on the pros of the chess life, yeah, not the poetry which you usually get into in the book, which are intended to entertain you, but into the prose. How is it to make this all everyday small decisions? How to do these tactics, which is not black and white, which doesn't have a nice point at the end of the line, but you simply need to do your chores and have a look at this. How to defend positions, for example. There are very few good books on positional defense, because that's such a gruesome stuff, you know, to defend the position for 50 moves, and maybe you will lose anyway. But for example, being able to positionally defend for a long time and to know how to do that is one of the main cornerstones how to get into professional chess. I'm deeply convinced about that. So there are several topics which are, I think, very important for a young player or adult club player to be dealt with in order to improve, but they just don't sell well, like in the text. So what we did with David is that we tried to put these topics into one book, although they are not that fancy, and we just wanted to focus, like, hey guys, these are the topics, please work on them, and that's how Secret Ingredients came into life.
Yeah, and again, definitely highly recommend the book. I really enjoyed the chapter on defense, and it resonated with me, the idea that you presented about it's not talked about very often. And you sort of break down defense into three sort of types of defense. Would you be able to elaborate on that a bit? Now, I think a lot of the people listening, because I think that's even, like, I agree with you that that's how you get to anywhere near your level, for example. Like, that really resonated with me as a 2100 player. But I think maybe lower on the scale, you do need to defend well, especially against checkmate. But it maybe becomes increasingly important the better you get. But in any event, Jan, could you briefly describe the sort of three ways that you mentioned of trying to hold on to a position?
Yes, we actually mentioned four of them. One of them was defense by fortress, like trying to keep the position as it is and just hold your castle. Another one was defense by counter attack. The third one was defense by simplifications, and the fourth one was such a strange one. I don't really remember how it was in English, but sabotage, defense by sabotage. That's a very unique one where we just felt that sabotage is not the same thing as counterattack. It's just, you know, making little annoyances to your right. opponent so that he cannot attack so freely and easily. And okay, when you say this, it's not rocket science, you know. Like, everyone defended something by simplification. Everyone defended by keeping the fortress, holding the fortress. But what we need is clarity. Yeah, we need the habit to say to yourself, okay, I'm in a worse position. How am I going to defend? There are four ways. Which one is suitable here? Yeah, and this is what you can find in the book, and you can reasonably quickly decide which strategy to adapt and when to change it, for example. So this might help to actually make the decisions quicker and easier. Because if you just skip this strategical and abstract phase when you are thinking a board, and you just skip immediately into lines and moves, you might miss very interesting possibilities.
Yeah, and the what you wrote about the fortress really resonated with me. I recently played first tournament in a long time, and I had a game where I was worse but should be okay. And that was exactly what the position called for. It's one of these positions where you just kind of have to grovel and not do anything. And eventually, I felt like my opponent shouldn't have enough pressure to win the game. But, you know, I'm an advanced enough player where I'm familiar with the concept of sometimes when you have an edge in a position, you should do nothing and kind of wait for your opponent to screw up. But in working with my coach and looking at that game, Grandmaster Axel Bachmann, he pointed out, I basically tried to do too much. Like, I had this impression of breaking free in the game. You know, I had this impression of, like, finally I had some activity and I just went for it. And the activity is what let him, my opponent, go on to win the game. So the idea that I just needed to sort of, and it was a queen and two rooks against a queen and two rooks and a bunch of pawns. Apologies for all the chess details without a diagram to the listeners. But anyway, it was a position where it's not intuitive that you just don't do anything and just, like, let them, you know, try to make progress. Mm-hmm. But I was nodding my head a lot when you wrote that, because it was, like, the exact description of, like, why I lost the game.
Well, actually, in some positions, you just need consciously to allow yourself to do nothing.
Yeah,
exactly. Because we just feel that, okay, I should do something. I should do something extraordinary to keep the game, to keep the game alive, to get half a point or more. But actually, in many positions, you just don't need to do that. It's a different way of looking at activity and what you actually need to do to achieve success.
Yeah, and as you say, the very fact of like having this framework that you lay out in mind can be very helpful, because then you kind of know your objective. You're not just like taking it move to move. You know, like, okay, I'm doing nothing, you know, like that's my goal. And I think it can be helpful to know what you're trying to achieve, even if that thing that you're trying to achieve is actually nothing.
I'll add to that. When you are looking at computer games, for example, or at games of top players, there is a lot of waiting. Surprisingly,
yeah.
Surprisingly, a lot of waiting, especially in the computer games. They just find some kind of equilibrium and they are doing nothing around that for maybe 20, 30 moves.
Yeah, and it's amazing how that can shift. Yeah, and that's really notable. And as you mentioned, Matthew Sadler and Natasha Regan's Game Changer, they'll just sit there and torture you, but they're playing another computer, so they can't really be tortured. But I wanted to read you another quote. This one is actually from Grandmaster David Navarra, but I think you can still expound on it, which is, you asked David, what is the biggest misconception club players believe about Grandmaster chess? And David said, I think the importance of the openings is overestimated. Club players often say, first, I need to build a decent repertoire of openings. Then I'll focus on the middle game and end game. To tell you the truth, you'll never have a repertoire that you'll be completely satisfied with. It's a Sisyphean, sorry if I said that wrong, effort. There's simply too much theory out there and it's evolving all the time. So another one that really, I felt seen, it resonated.
Yes, it's really a Sisyphean work. I mean, yeah. And it's a dull work as well. I mean, it turns us into some monkeys who just, you know, are going along these trees of openings and watching what the computer says and so on. It's somehow, it doesn't dignify us too much. So I really hate working on openings, honestly. And even in my games, I'm not on playing too much. I'm trying to divert as quickly as possible to just get the game. But yes, I mean, what is it good for when you get, I don't know, plus 0.4 as white, when you just don't understand the position and you just, you know, ruin it in two or three moves. So, and I know how David is playing, for example. He is voluntarily taking risks just to take the opponent, especially the nominally weaker ones, into some interesting area. He's risking a lot in openings and playing rather superficially in openings just to get the game. So this is his approach, fighting one.
Yeah, it's another sort of psychological phenomenon where you can be aware of the sort of tendency to overemphasize openings or feel like you have to work on them, but still the awareness and the actual behavioral change, there's a gap between them which calls to mind time trouble, which is another topic that you write quite poetically in some cases and helpfully in others. So for listeners who play mostly online, time trouble, of course, is when, I mean, you probably know even from playing online, but I think it comes across more in tournament chess where you're given a lot of time, but it has a way of just sort of slipping away. And you tell some great stories I guess I wouldn't call them stories, but you highlight the clock management of some very strong players and go through a few of positions, critical positions where they use a lot of time. One, of course, being the number one champion of somehow being amazing at chess while still playing in time trouble, Alexander Grushuk, but also Grandmaster Daniel Friedman. You show a few examples of positions where one shouldn't necessarily think. So I don't know if either of those sort of quote-unquote stories would fit better with an audio-only podcast, but Jan, if you could sort of walk us through that sort of psychological phenomenon, I'm sure that listeners, in addition to myself, are, you know, struggle with this.
Yes, I mean, we need to we need to keep in mind that we are not only chess players but also humans. That our human emotions and the way how we are deciding, somehow we are trying to make it work together with the game of chess. And sometimes we just decide wrongly because we are transposing the way how we are deciding in the normal world to the chess world and vice versa. And some things which are, you know, quite common are, for example, the huge mistake that we are deciding for a long time because the two alternatives are approximately of the same value. We just think, okay, it's difficult to distinguish between them. They're approximately of the same value, so let's find the best one. But that's also, very, very impractical, because there is a rule, which is also stated in the Secret Ingredient, that the more important the decision is, the more time you should work on it, basically. And the importance of the decision you can distinguish by comparing the best and the second best option. Yeah. So when the options are approximately of the same value, just pick one and make a move in a minute or two, and not as Daniel Friedman, who was just looking at the position where he could have gotten two basically identical endgames, and he was just looking at them for 60 minutes because he couldn't decide which one of them is better. Even although marginally. So you should just make a move and decide. And then in positions where the chance to make a huge mistake is quite great, there you should burn all your time or most of your time. For example, with positions where there's a lot of tactics, advanced passpawn, bear kings, and so on and so on. So that's a big that's one of the big mistakes we sometimes do. I also do that. Sorry, Daniel, for mentioning you, but
yeah,
that somehow happened. Another huge mistake which we do is that we somehow use the time not for deciding, but rather for, you know, for example, persuading yourself into the move, or I don't know, cursing that you have done something wrongly beforehand, or for any other non-chess thoughts. I have an example of Vasily Ivanchuk, who knew that he just messed up in the opening and that he needs to make a break, but he saw that the resulting position is rather dangerous for him. So he was thinking for maybe, I don't know, 45 minutes, and then he played the move anyway, and he got the same dangerous continuation from Levon Aronian, was playing white, but without this 45 minutes. What was the mistake of Vasily Ivanchuk? The mistake was that he wasn't deciding. He was just, you know, he was thinking about chess, he was thinking about the position, but he wasn't deciding. And when he wasn't deciding, he shouldn't have burned this time, basically. And there are many, 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 many other stuff. For example, there's a very interesting question to be dealt with, like whether you should think on your opponent's time or not. And we are also explaining together with David how to decide rationally whether you just should take a rest or rather work as hard as on your time.
Yeah, so many great insights there. And as you say, mentioning a player like Grandmaster Daniel Friedman or Vasily Ivanchuk, obviously we're not trying to like put them on blast and make them look bad. If anything, it's just like for someone like me, it makes them all the more human, because I and others struggle with this sort of thing so much. And echoing what you said, I'll never forget when I interviewed Sam Shanklin many years ago. One of the bits of advice he gave was those situations where you know what move you're going to play and you're trying to make it work. And he said, just play it, because you know you're going to play it. So like, you know, skip the sitting there for 25 minutes, because you might as well just use that time. And that I also had a sort of follow-up question, because I've experienced situations, and you show your game with, I believe the opponent's name was Cernasek. I wasn't familiar with the player, but where you took him out of book on move three, because you identified he's a very strong Grünfeld player, so you're going to play a move that you know isn't supposed to be the best, but you'll get him thinking, and it worked very effectively. But what would you recommend in a position where you're unfamiliar with the opening and you feel like you have to solve a problem? Like, how much is enough in terms of like trying to solve the problem in the opening, as opposed to just like at some point realizing, as you say, you're not going to lose on the spot, so just make a move?
Well, that's a question which cannot be answered generally, perhaps. But normally, when you are confronted by some new concept or some new idea, the normal thing to do is not to refute the novelty or the unknown concept, but rather to postpone the important part of the game to the later stage. So just making some normal moves, maybe a little bit odd move, where you might think, okay, maybe my opponent didn't check this so well. For I might give an example. I was playing a guy, a grandmaster in Slovakia, and he played something like d4, knight f6, bishop f4, which was a thing that I wasn't aware of, because as I told you before, I don't study openings much, and I knew that he it wasn't his main weapon. So I just went b6 or some random move,
right, yeah.
where I knew that perhaps he wasn't checking that. And then we were playing both, and we postponed the important part of the game for later. Of course, this cannot be done when the challenge you are facing is of tactical character, for example, or when you are in a danger to get into a position where you are strategically worse without any counterplay. Like in these positions where the tide is shifting and where you might actually lose a lot, I would recommend to work a lot, even when you are facing an opening novelty.
Okay, so in rare circumstances,
it's
good. That's good to hear. And Jan, if we could tie together your advice, I have a feeling based on the way you write and your sort of well-read broad range of interest background that you won't like trying to answer this question, but I feel compelled to ask it anyway, which is, what advice do you give for chess improvers about how to allocate their study time? Like if you have, say, an hour and a half a day, how should they spend the time with so many potential issues to be addressed?
Well, first of all, introspect the motivation of the player. Yeah, why am I playing chess anyway? Yeah, do I want to enjoy myself? Do I want to achieve successes? Do I want to be a professional later on? Or what's my motivation? Because that's quite important, I think. Because if I'm a club player who wants just to enjoy myself, I would focus on things that actually bring me this joy. Yeah, I wouldn't just push myself into some drill or torture for a long time, because if it doesn't fit with my motivation, I will just go away from it very quickly and just stop the drill after a week or two. But if I really want to improve, there is a very important part of finding some kind of harmony between playing and working on chess, because when you are playing so much that you don't have time to analyze your own games, something is wrong. And when you are working a lot without actually playing, that's also wrong, because then you just feel that you are wasting your time working because you cannot show it anywhere. So finding some kind of work-play balance is important. I would say that for a player who really wants to improve, like 40, 50 games a year is a minimum. For a club player who just wants to enjoy himself but just wants to keep in some kind of working shape, 25 games should be fine. Also, I think it's very important to analyze your own games, and also what I really think is a very nice tool to work on or to work with is to find a friend and play sparring games.
Yeah,
just try to work on that as well. So there should be a huge portion of analysis of your own games. There should be some portion of just reading the literature to getting the knowledge in words, and there should be the drill, the calculation as well. I would I would avoid learning opening theory by heart. Rather, I would suggest, for example, picking up a player which whose style I like and just copying his or her repertoire, studying the games and also the ideas. So well, there's a lot what can be said about this. Maybe I said my answer was too complex, but it's an interesting question, of course, how to build up some training plan which actually works for the person. But I would start with motivation. Just clarify your motivation. Why are you playing? Because if you answer, I just want to be better because of my ego, that's kind of not enough. Yeah. Just let's try. If your answer is just like this, like I want to feel better and have a higher rating, maybe just think about what inspired you in chess 10, 20 years ago. And let's just try to lighten up this spark again. And that will paradoxically get you better results in the future. When you are a little bit unpractical, a little bit emotional about chess, a little bit, you know, in love with chess, you will get better.
Great advice and echoes of what Grandmaster Vladimir Kramnik said in my recent interview. I mean, he was really sort of all about the sort of the growth mindset, the sort of just playing for its own sake. It was sort of a theme that resonated throughout the interview. And when we did ask him about chess improvement, that was basically what he said. Just do what you like. Now, we won't all end up being world champions, of course. But I do think it's a healthy outlook. Now, Jan, of course, you came up in the sort of, you're 36, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you came up, at the dawn of the digital age, I guess you could say. So a lot of listeners now play primarily online. And I know that when you give advice like play ideally 50 games a year, if not 25, we're talking about tournaments. Now, we have a lot of people listening who maybe have played a few tournaments or maybe they played when they're kids, but now they are parents and they play more online. So if there's people who are more online focused, but do have some interest in improving their games, how would you adapt that advice? I mean, obviously, what you said about sparring partners is helpful, but what else can they do? Do they need to go to tournaments in order to improve?
Well, could I return for a second to Vladimir Kramnik? Because that was very interesting what you said. I have a big admiration to him when it comes to his love and to how passionate he is about chess. Because he completely changed his style after he was the world champion. And afterwards, he was drawing so many games and so on. And then he started to play ultra sharp and various openings and this and that and sacrificing pieces and risking a lot and so on. And I was just so happy seeing that.
Yeah.
That even such a mature player can just try to, you know, get some new experience about chess, from chess and find a new approach. So I think that his advice was from heart because he was actually doing it himself. But sorry, let's get back to online chess and to us parents who don't have time to play tournaments and so. First of all, online world is addictive. So that is the case also with, for example, blitz games. So playing mindlessly blitz games for 3 hours wouldn't make you happier and wouldn't make you, you know, more relaxed and wouldn't, you know, teach you much, I'm afraid. So I would think about, first of all, playing longer formats if possible, so longer time controls, maybe 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes if possible. Also maybe playing with people you know or the person knows, maybe having a little bit chat after the game, analyzing together, or surely it's a good idea to analyze every game I play, or even online. And also maybe just setting some limits to oneself. Like, okay, I'm going to play blitz games because I don't have time for more, but I will play 5 games and I want to play them as well as possible. Yeah? And I'm not going to play 25 games and in the end ending to play h4, a4, the first 2 moves because I'm so right. much, you know, enraged that I just want to do anything. So that's what I would recommend. I myself, I'm almost not playing online because I just feel it's an addictive thing. But I understand that for many people, it's the only possibility to get a game.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent advice. And Jan, we're going to take one more break, and then I'd like to hear a little bit more about your own climb through the ranks and your life today. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes space repetition to quiz you and make sure that you remember whatever tactical patterns or opening sequences that you're working on. They have a huge catalog of great books from top flight authors, both for purchase. And if you check for their short and sweet courses, you can find tons of free content. Speaking of free content, Chessable, of course, has also recently launched an adult improvement focused chess podcast called How to Chess, with yours truly hosting it. Check for it on Chessable's YouTube channel, and you can also subscribe on the podcast platforms.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
And we are back. So Jan, we've been talking a lot about sort of dispensing advice for others, but I'd like to hear a bit about your own climb in the chess world. I'm guessing, based on our conversation, that you read your fair share of chess books, but like, what combination for you of chess improvement came from competing as compared to lessons, as compared to solving tactics, as compared to reading books?
Well, I was always a reader, so I've read a lot. I never had a structured training. That's maybe surprising, but I never had a schedule saying that, okay, Monday you do three hours of work, Tuesday you do four, and so on and so on. So I just worked when I felt like it, and I didn't work when I just didn't feel like it. I also was helped by a huge amount by Lubomir Vtáčnik, which is the chess legend from Slovakia,
yeah,
person,
legend.
Grandmaster who played maybe 20 Olympiads or so. So he helped me a lot about understanding chess. One of the first things he told me actually was like, forget about openings and let's come and analyze. So that was
amazing.
Nice. Yeah, and I was always quite lazy, so I didn't do the drill part so much. But maybe it's a mistake. Maybe I could have played better. I don't know. But I really like always when it started to be a little bit mindless, just remembering theory or learning theory and calculating, I just lost my interest and tried to do something else. So for that reason, I'm playing, for example, the Sicilian Svechnikov for 25 years because I never found the motivation to learn another opening on Grandmaster level. Sometimes I hate the Svechnikov already, but, you know, being lazy.
Yeah, a lot of theory these days. I mean, there's always theory, but yeah, I feel like it's exploded with Magnus playing it in the World Championship especially.
Yeah, but okay, with you know, 25 years of experience, you can sidestep somewhere and just play the position. That's fine with me.
Yeah, that makes sense. And at what age did you start chess, Jan?
Well, I've learned the rules maybe around age of 7. And then I started to play some tournaments when I was 10, maybe.
Oh, okay. Late start.
Yeah, rather late start, yes.
Yeah. And what were your favorite books? You mentioned, obviously, you've always been a reader. Chess books, that is.
Well, there are surprisingly good books in the Czechoslovak region. For example, Mr. Pachman. I don't know whether you are familiar of his books. He wrote several very good books, but I'm not sure how much they were translated into English. Somewhere, definitely. Well, lately I really admire the free books of Boris Gelfand, for example, which are really good, being written by a very, very, very strong player. And again, the language is important for me, that they were written in such a style that you can actually understand the ideas, not just the moves. And of course, we have all the stars, as Jakub Agard and Boretsky and so on, so, and Jonathan Rosen, and you name it, them all. It's just...
There's so many great ones today. It's amazing. And then, of course, there's all the video content on top of that. And hearing you mention Gelfand's books, I was lucky enough to interview him, another of your fellow quality chess writers. And he did cop to the fact, and Jakub Agard mentions in the intro to one of his books that, you know, it's sort of their books are very much collaborative. Even though Gelfand is listed as the author, I think a lot of it is sort of them talking, Boris talking through his thought process and Jakub helping it put into words. But what does a more traditional quality chess writer like yourself, how do you approach your books? You'd mentioned earlier, I wasn't sure from what you said earlier, if you were writing the books in English or writing the books in your native language, and what's your general approach to getting down your thoughts?
Well, I'm writing them in Slovak and then get them translated, because they are published in Slovak as well.
Okay.
So in Czech Republic and Slovakia, and actually like maybe half of the books is sold in this region. So they're
amazing,
popular in these two countries. So this is how we do that. Maybe I could speak about how we wrote the book with David.
Sure.
Maybe also quite interesting, because David is not it's not like, you know, I'm being the ghostwriter and he's being the big name there. We are friends for a long, long time. He's 3 months older than myself, so we played all these championships together and so on. So we know each other very, very well. And we were writing it mostly through the pandemic and he's in Prague, so we just were speaking via Skype mostly, but we were discussing a lot before I started the first sentence, basically. Yeah, so we even what is like what is written by myself was just, you know, approved and discussed with David. So that's very interesting. I think that I have the ability to explain in a clear language, and he's got, of course, the experience which I don't have, the experience of the 27 player, which is very unique even for me. So that was also important for me, that I was actually interested what he's going to say, and I hope that it shows up in the book as well, that actually I was interested and that it was interesting.
Yeah, it definitely comes across. And that's interesting to hear that your books are so popular in Slovakia. I mean, again, as one of the strongest players in your country, it does make sense some. But how is, I mean, the Czech Republic, I feel like I have a bit of a better feel for than Slovakia. How is the chess culture there? Is chess pretty popular there? And are you ever being like recognized on the street? And I'm just curious about stuff like that.
Well, when I'm being recognized, I'm being recognized because of my non-chess books.
And non-chess amazing.
Books, mostly. Well, Czech Republic is perhaps has a significantly higher chess culture. There are more tournaments, more great players, more sponsors, let's say. But in Slovakia, chess is pretty popular as well. It's being like maybe 6th or 7th most popular sport in Slovakia. We have like 5 or 6 leagues and plenty, plenty club players playing each other. And so we don't have the top players for some reason. Maybe there's not enough funding, or we don't have such a shining star as David Navar is. So there is no one to drag the players up. I don't know. But okay, usually we think about the Czech region and the Slovak region as being like one chess family, because the languages are very similar, and people are traveling from Czech Republic to Slovakia to play, and the other way around. So yeah, Czechoslovakia in the chess world, Czechoslovakia still exists.
That's good to hear, and it's great that you're still finding so much time for chess despite all of your success outside of chess. Do you find it hard to balance them?
Well, when I'm trying to balance something, it's more family and work.
Yeah,
because family needs a lot of time, obviously. So this is the most important stuff. But okay, I turned down, for example, the invitation to play the European Championship in Iceland in September, just because I have other things to do, non-chess things. So sometimes it's like that I just don't play tournaments because I need to do something else. But okay, that's life.
And was there a moment where that changed for you? I mean, obviously you've accomplished a lot in the chess world. You've had a lot of opportunity. So was it when the kids came, or was it before or after that?
Well, I always just felt that it's maybe not enough to play just only chess. So usually when a young chess player decides to go for the university and just, you know, devote the time to study, not just fake it, but really like study, then the decision is already made, I would say. It's very difficult to improve when you want to do the studies and the job well.
Yeah, makes sense.
But honestly, I'm fine with that. It's just okay for me. I feel very satisfied that I'm writing books that are being read, and that I'm coaching people which are satisfied with that, and I don't really need to, you know, be a strong, very strong player or whatever. It's a kind of lonely occupation, I would say. You know, just trying to beat everyone. And, like, why?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the travel, again, echoing Jonathan Rowson, that's something that he sort of struggled with, the sort of existential question of, like, what am I even doing? And obviously he's moved on primarily to other pursuits as well. But when you do think about your chess career, obviously, as we mentioned earlier, you've played some truly elite players and accomplished a lot in your own right. What are your fondest memories, Jan?
Well, I was the European champion under 16. That's quite a long time ago, but that's something I'm returning back with fond memories, basically.
Where was that tournament?
It was in Greece, 2001, I think, maybe 2000, I'm not sure. And I won the Riga University Open Tournament once. That was also nice. And I've beaten Jan Krzysztof Duda, who was beating Carlsens. And that wasn't so long ago, actually, maybe 3 or 4 years. So, but okay, he had a bad game. He was better than me even then, but... It's nice to see how the guy you have beaten is beating Carlsen. That's
going to the candidates. And yeah, as we record this, so this will be out in a couple of weeks, but yeah, Jan Krzysztof Duda is in the final against Karjakin, of course, and of the Chess World Cup, the FIDE Chess World Cup. And of course, by reaching the finals, he and Karjakin both have secured coveted spots in the candidates tournament to determine who challenges in the 2022 cycle the winner of the upcoming Carlsen-Nepomniachtchi World Championship match. So are you still finding time with all of your work responsibilities and your family and your writing? Are you still able to sort of, like, when the World Cup's going on, how much attention are you paying to it, Jan?
Well, I'm replaying the games once they have ended, but I'm not watching the broadcasts. That's just too much time to devote to that. Of course, the people who are doing the broadcast are often like very funny and it's very enjoyable, but I just can't find so much time. But yeah, I'm trying to have a look at the games because I'm just interested in what's going on in the chess world.
Yeah, I hope I'm not telling tales out of school, but when I interviewed Kramnik, it was also during the World Cup, and I said, thanks for doing this during the game, because it was about an hour into the World Cup, and he said, oh, are they playing today?
Yeah, well, that's, yeah. There are actually quite a few these top events. So if you want to follow them all, that's might be quite time consuming.
Yeah, I feel that way, especially now with the online events. But the World Cup, I try to carve out time for as best I can. So Jana, I think we've covered most of the topics I wanted to cover. I am curious. I mean, I feel like we've gotten a good sense, in addition to some great chess advice, we've gotten a good sense of your personality. But are there any sort of outside interests that you haven't mentioned? I mean, you're pretty busy with reading, work, and family. But do you have any other hobbies outside of those and chess?
Well, yeah, I like poetry, for example. I like Japan, Japanese tea, Japanese arts, and all of this stuff. We do a lot of hiking with the family, and so on. Yeah.
And have you been to Japan?
No, not yet. But maybe one day. They don't play chess, you know. They have their own chess, and that's a nuisance. Yeah, I would really love to go there to play a tournament, but they are just not playing our chess. So what can I do?
Yeah. Next time. Makes it harder to schedule a trip around it. Okay. Well, Jan, I'm going to give some instructions for your book giveaway. So just bear with me for a minute. But I will, first of all, just want to reiterate, as listeners can probably tell, Jan's books are incredible. So I highly recommend anyone who's found this interview compelling to check out both Under the Surface and The Secret Ingredient. So for the book giveaway, we're going to give away three books this time. And what we're going to do is continue to shamelessly promote our other podcast, How to Chess. So if you want to enter this giveaway, what you need to do is email me a screenshot that you subscribed to How to Chess on any platform. It doesn't matter. It can also be on Chessable's YouTube channel. As long as you just show me a screenshot that you're subscribed in the email, then you are entered in the contest. So email ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, Jan's book is available in physical form as well as on Forward Chess, both of his recent books. So to the extent possible, I will let you all choose. But if it's somewhere that's difficult to ship to you, we may have to get you the Forward Chess book. We'll see how that goes. So just wanted to announce that before we say goodbye, Jan. But now it is that time. Do you have anything to add before we call it a night in Bratislava and an afternoon here in New Jersey?
Well, surely I do. Thank you for the invitation, Ben. It was a nice hour which we had together. And I hope that everyone who is listening to us will improve a lot in their game and that they will have a lot of nice chess experiences in the future.
Thank you so much. And actually, one more, Jan. Are there more chess books in your future? I certainly hope so.
I'm not sure about that, but maybe we will see.
Okay, so nothing in the works, but we'll keep our fingers crossed. And Jan, I believe your email address is in the intro to your book. You seem like a fairly offline person, but is that right? Is your email address public?
Yes, my email address is public. It's jan.marcos@gmail.com. So if you have any other questions that spring into your mind, please just write me an email and I will be happy to answer.
Okay, excellent. All right, so listeners, we'll put the links to the books in the show description as well as Jan's email address. And Jan, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your wisdom with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible, most of all to my producer, Matthew Passy. I also would like to thank everyone who helped spread the word about the show. Did you guys know that there's still people who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast? There's even chess players who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast. So we need to fix that. And the ways to do that include writing positive reviews on podcast platforms or YouTube comments, telling friends. All that stuff makes a difference in helping spread the word about the show. But of course, I most of all want to thank people who provide financial support to the show. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible. So without further ado, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, Apprentice Twitch Channel, Aniti Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Heat, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Snyder, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Farhan Thawar, Barasawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, I am Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Cell, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnaze Twitch channel, Grandmaster Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Flummins, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Ross Crossland, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Bean, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio K. Leonfort, FM Andre Terakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard, Lynn, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Patser Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Blaskoczek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Tennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Melo Paria, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Francis Letarte Lavoir, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Han Shu, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Behan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Benastio, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jadeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse Zakumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe Dasano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almagar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, WGM Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katarina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, I am Kostya Kravutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Ryforth, Laura Boyovsky, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanova, aka PhotoChess, Mark Shaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Negma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Blaine, Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited of Switzerland, Randall Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Sergey McCagan, Seth Ruzica, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatev Abrahamian, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks to you all for the support, and we will catch you all next week. Thank you.
Sports Social Podcast Network.